From the studios of the Living on Earth Network in Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Living on Earth Today. It may surprise some, but women explorers are not a modern phenomenon. For centuries, women have left what was familiar to embark on voyages of discovery. Often these women went beyond the mores of their society and, in the face of formidable challenges, helped to expand the world's body of knowledge. Most of these women have remained unknown, and no small number died alone or forgotten. As author Milbury Polk writes, to go beyond the narrow perimeters set by culture was usually to become an outlaw, literally to be cast out by society to die. Milbury Polk is herself an explorer, and she's written a new book called Women of Discovery, Celebration of Intrepid Women Who Explored the World. She hopes to bring some of these women out of obscurity. Milbury Polk joined me in the studios of Living on Earth. Milbury, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Before we get into some specific stories, tell me what the research process was like for this book, considering that many of these women are unknown or little known to history.
The research process was a long and serendipitous one. It's not a subject that you can easily go to the library and look up. So we found a lot of these women in footnotes of other books. Or I'd be at a dinner party and somebody would say, "Women explorers, well, there was that crazy woman who was down in the Amazon 20 years ago, but she's probably dead." So then I would follow up on who that was. So in the end, we chose about 84 women that covered 2,000 years of history, more than a dozen different nationalities, and their endeavors crossed a wide swath of interests from every kind of science to art and geography and painting, whatever their particular means were. And honestly, we chose most of them because we really liked them.
In your book, there's a picture of Mary Henrietta Kingsley. And in this picture, she's dressed in the proper attire for her era, Victorian England. She's got a hat, a parasol, gloves. But Kingsley, in her 30s, traveled to the Congo as a trader at the time when that part of Africa was known as the white man's graveyard. What motivated her, and what was her experience in Africa?
When she was young, her father had a perfect horror of educated women, and he only allowed her to learn German so she could translate articles for him. But he was luckily gone a lot, and so she could go into his library where she educated herself. When her parents died in her early 30s, her brother wrote her a letter saying, "Now that our parents are dead, you can move in and take care of me the way you took care of them." But instead, she decided to blow her small inheritance on a ticket to the Canary Islands, which was quite a brave thing to do. And she went there, and it was when she was there she heard about this perfectly dreadful place that you were guaranteed to die within 6 months called the White Man's Graveyard, and that's where she wanted to go. She went home to England, got a small commission from the British Museum to collect fish, and outfitted herself as a trader so she could support herself paddling up and down the tributaries, buying and selling. And she learned the language of the Fang, who were then greatly feared as cannibals. She traveled widely with them and was really entranced with their way of life. And let me describe, read a passage where she describes the, who she called the Fan, because she didn't want to give them their real name, which was Fang, and that they're called that because they filed their teeth into points. She described them as full of fire, temper, intelligence, and go. But I ought to confess, people who have known him better than I do say he is a treacherous, thievish, murderous cannibal. I never found him treacherous or thievish, and I like him better than any African as a tribe I have yet met. He is a cannibal, not from superstitious motives like the Negro tribes. He just does it in his common sense way. Man's flesh, he assures me, is very good, and he wishes I would try it. She, by the way, is not the only woman in the book who spent time with people feared as cannibals. There are a couple of others. And maybe also it's because they were unarmed women who had a purpose, that they were really taken up by these people and not feared or otherwise harmed. And one thing that Kingsley quickly determined was that the spiritual life of these people, she felt, was on par with Christianity, which at the time, you have to remember, every little town, had its own missionary society, that people were busy raising money to send out their missionaries to convert the heathens around the world. So they didn't want to hear that the heathens had something that didn't need converting.
She also has something to say about proper attire while in the Congo, doesn't she? What does she say about that?
Well, she felt that it, like a proper Victorian, that she wanted to greet the people of Africa the same way that she would greet her own people on her. So she wanted to show them the respect that she would show in her own street. So she wanted to dress the way she was in Africa, the same way that she dressed in England. And actually, quite a few women felt that way, too. It was a sign of respect for the people that you were encountering. And she actually credits her thick skirts with saving her life, because she fell into a pit that had sharpened stakes in it for capturing animals, and she landed on her skirts, and the stakes couldn't penetrate her skirts. So she wrote about the blessings of a good thick skirt.
Milbury Polk is co-author of Women of Discovery, a celebration of intrepid women who explored the world.
I curled up on the boxes with my head on the tobacco sack and dozed. Waking up, I noticed the smell in the hut was violent. Knocking the ash off a smoldering bush light that lay burning on the floor, I investigated and tracked it to a bag. I shook its contents out in my hat for fear of losing anything of value. They were a human hand, three big toes, four eyes, two ears, and other portions of the human frame. The hand was fresh, the others only so-so and shriveled. Replacing them, I tied the bag up and hung it up again. Subsequently, I learned that although the fans will eat their fellow friendly tribes, they like to keep a little something belonging to them as a memento. This touching trait in their character I learned from Wiki, my guide. Still, it's an unpleasant practice when they hang the remains in the bedroom you occupy.
One of the women you chronicle in your book was a mountaineer named Annie Smith Peck, who scaled mountains during the suffragette era in the late 1880s. You write that she got into the news not because of her accomplishments, per se, but because of what she wore when she was doing them.
Right. She was a very fascinating character. She was a professor of Latin at Smith College, and her moment of epiphany happened during a train ride across Europe when she saw the Matterhorn, and she just knew that somehow her life was connected to mountains, although up till that point it had been in the university. She quit her job and became a mountaineer and was the third woman to summit the Matterhorn, and she did so in pants. And it was such an outrageous thing that Singer's sewing machine included a picture of her in pants with every Singer machine it sold. And I like to tell the story that there's some argument about whether she's actually the third or the fourth woman, because the second woman to summit did so in skirts, obviously, but she took her skirts off near the top. And when she went back down to the alpinist hut, they wouldn't let her in because she didn't have her skirts on. They made her climb back up again and get her skirts. So Annie may be the third or the fourth person, depending on how you look at that. And she went on to be the first woman to scale a major peak in the world, and that was in Peru. And she had a very tough time because the males that were with her, she had a very bad luck in hiring people that tried to sabotage all of her climbs. Mm-hmm. But she was climbing until the very end of her life. A really remarkable woman. Mm-hmm. She also said, "My home is where my trunk is," and literally that's true. She did not have a home after that, and most of her life then was spent trying to raise funds, writing articles, giving lectures for her climbs. And an ironic thing happened to her. In the 1980s, in Brooklyn, New York, a woman noticed there was a very unusual trunk sitting in the trash outside, and she asked her husband to bring it in. And when she opened up the trunk, she saw it was full of letters written in Victorian script with photographs and journals. And she thought somebody'd made a terrible mistake. She went around the neighborhood. She found the place where the trunk had come from. And the woman said, "Oh, no, there's another one like it in the basement. Go get that, too." They were what was left of Annie's papers. So she luckily saved them, and she gave them all to Brooklyn College, where they're being now archived, but just for the probably 20 minutes, we would have lost an enormous treasure trove. Again, she was a woman unsupported by any institution. Nobody was interested in her papers. Nobody collected them the way that they collected other people that were affiliated. And it was just by chance that they were saved.
Makes you wonder about the papers that weren't saved.
Oh, many, many, many weren't. It's really a tragedy.
Annie Smith Peck was expected to scale mountains in skirts. What were some of the other expectations of women explorers throughout various times?
Well, I think that most people didn't expect anything because they didn't want them to be there in the first place. And so they were sort of an oddity. And people would come to hear Mary Kingsley just to see this strange woman that lived in the jungles, or they would... It was more of a very unusual, and people didn't really often know how to deal with these people. I think today we've moved beyond that, and we really can celebrate these differences and the things that people are doing.
In order to do the things that they did, when they did them, did these women have to have money? Did they have to have prestige? Did they have to have a certain physical ability? What allowed them to do what they did despite the conventions of their times?
Well, a lot of people have criticized explorers in general and women explorers in particular as being a very rarefied group of rich white women. And we found that while that is sometimes true, it's certainly not true across the board. And in fact, many of the women were not well-connected and had no money. But what unifies all of these women is that their overriding passion for something in the world and their very firm belief that what they were doing was absolutely right and very valuable, and so they would surmount any obstacles that came their way.
Milbrae Polk is co-author of Women of Discovery, a celebration of intrepid women who explored the world.
My recollection of the descent is as of a horrible nightmare. The little moon seemed always at my back, casting a shadow over the place where I must step. The poncho would sway in the wind, and with my motion as I was in the act of stepping, would sometimes conceal the spot where my foot should be placed. Although my eye for distance is good, my foot once missed the step, slipping then on the smooth slope, so I fell, as usual in the sitting posture, crying out at the same time to warn the guides. I expected nothing serious, but to my horror I did not remain where I was. Still sitting, I began to slide down that glassy, ghastly incline. As we were all nearly in the same line, I slid at least 15 feet before coming to a halt when checked by the rope. Now to get back. The guides called me to get up, but being all in a heap with a rope tied around my waist, I was unable to move. The guides, therefore, came together just above and hauled me up the slope. Thankful again to be in the line of the steps, though more alarmed than ever, I went onward, resolved to be more careful. But again I slipped, and again slid far below. While from the beginning of the descent I had greatly feared the outcome, after these slips my terror increased. Several times I declared that we should never get down alive.
In a book with many incredible women, my most memorable character is someone named Lady Mary Pierpont Wortley Montagu, who was so outrageous for her time in the 18th century that her own daughter burned her papers. Tell me about Lady Montagu.
Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, an English woman, married against her parents' wishes, and because of this lost a great deal of her potential inheritance. But nonetheless, her husband was eventually appointed to be the ambassador to the Sultan of Turkey. And she, against all convention, decided to go with him. It was not something that court ladies were really even allowed to do, but she managed to do it. And she wrote a series of letters home about her experiences that were later gathered together and published, against the will of her daughter, but other people had copies of them so that they were gathered. But what she did was truly extraordinary. She traveled, first of all, without her husband and experienced life in Europe and then Eastern Europe and then down into Turkey that nobody from her time in England had ever dreamed existed. And once she got to Turkey, she went around the countryside and looked and saw how the Turkish people live. She went into baths. She went into harems. She really did quite a lot of extraordinary things. And she made a discovery that was really quite exceptional, is that she discovered that smallpox, which was then the great horror of Europe, I think fully a third of the people in Europe had died or were marred by it, but she discovered it wasn't quite as rampant in Turkey because the Turkish people practiced a form of vaccination that they had actually gotten from the Chinese. And she was so entranced with this, she had her own children vaccinated, brought back this knowledge to England. Because she was a member of the court, she was able to convince the king and queen that it was something that they ought to look into. They tried it on some condemned criminals, giving them the vaccination, putting them in a room with people dying of smallpox. Then when they didn't get sick, they were allowed to go free. Eventually, about 800 people were vaccinated, but she was attacked from the pulpit from religious people as consorting with the devil. And if she hadn't been so highly connected at court, she probably would have been burned as a witch. So that the knowledge of her discovery, which she brought back, was suppressed for a full 75 years before Jenner resurrected it, and he's now credited with the discovery of the vaccination. So many times that we found that it was women that made the initial breakthrough, and then others then got the credit for it later.
It really does seem like a number of the women explorers that you include in your book did approach the indigenous peoples that they encountered with a certain openness that perhaps some of their male counterparts did not.
Well, this, I think, is because traditionally, historically, and maybe to some extent today, women really did explore differently from men. And this is because they were historically excluded from those organizations that supported exploration, universities, governments, schools, the media. So it gave them a freedom. They didn't have to go find that prize that the men were under a lot of pressure to their patrons to find. And because the women then didn't have the support, they didn't have the money, they often traveled alone, so they were dependent upon many times the people with whom they lived. So they often learned the languages of where they went, and they saw the things that the larger expeditions, because of their very nature, obviously missed.
I went to the bathing house about 10 o'clock. It was already full of women. The first sofas were covered with cushions on which sat the ladies, and on the second their slaves behind them, but without any distinction of rank by their dress, all being in a state of nature. That is, in plain English, stark naked, without any beauty or defect concealed. Yet there was not the least wanton smile or immodest gesture amongst them. So many fine women naked, in different postures, some in conversation, some working, others drinking coffee, and many negligently lying on their cushions while their slaves were employed in braiding their hair. In short, 'tis the woman's coffee house, where all the news of the town is told, scandal invented, etc. They were all so earnest in persuading me, I was at last forced to open my shirt and show them my stays, which satisfied them very well, for I saw they believed I was so locked up in that machine that it was not in my own power to open it, which contrivance they attributed to my husband.
How do you define exploration, and has your definition of exploration evolved over the span of writing this book?
It certainly did evolve, and in fact, we had to create our own definition, otherwise we would have been swamped with people to include, so we had to be pretty tightly controlled, although we did break our own rules many times. But for me, growing up, I read a lot of books about explorers, and often people think of an explorer as somebody who's hacking his way through a jungle or trudging up a mountain or planting a flag on a distant shore. That, to me, is like super athletics. That's not exploration. Exploration is being curious about the world, having an open mind, having a lot of courage, and taking a risk. And by taking a risk, it's not, do I jump across this chasm? It's holding uncommon ideas. Even if everybody else thinks that you're wrong or silly or whatever, you know in your heart that you're right and you persevere. The most important criteria for an explorer is to communicate. All of these women in our book left a record of what they did. Because if you don't communicate it, whether writing or painting or photographing or however you document your discovery, it means nothing. So for us, explorers were people that were knowledgeable, they were curious, they were risk takers, and they were communicators. And they opened new vistas for the rest of us. They made bridges between disparate worlds.
Let's talk about a 20th century American explorer. Zora Hurston was an African-American who started out life as a maid in the segregated rural South. Eventually, she becomes an anthropologist and a folklorist, and she travels to Haiti in 1936 to study her passion, which was voodoo. And she seems to have done a bit more than just observe.
Yes, Zora Neale Hurston is best remembered today as one of the literary figures in the Harlem Renaissance, and she did quite a lot of writing. Some of it has now just been reissued. But I was very surprised when I was doing the reading for this book to find a mention of her in a discussion about Franz Boas and the early days of anthropology. And she actually began her life as an anthropologist. And she was sent by Boas down to the American South to collect folklore and folk tales. One of the pictures we have of her in the book is paddling through a swamp on her way to some backwoods places to collect their stories. And in the course of this, she became fascinated with the practice of voodoo, beginning in the American South and then New Orleans, and then she began tracing it back further and further. She wanted to find the place where it had the most African elements, and she ended up in Haiti, and she actually took the very first picture of a zombie, which we've included in the book. And it wasn't until the 1980s that Wade Davis was actually able to go down there and discover that it's the toxin of the pufferfish that causes a person's vital signs to be suppressed, and then they're buried, and then all the things happen. But she, I think, had quite an amazing experience and was really quite frightened by what she was finding. Again, she was alone, unsupported, in a very different world from the one that she came from, and she eventually went back and became a writer. She ended up her life as a maid and then living in a poorhouse in Florida, and when she died, all of her belongings were gathered, and they were being burned by the side of the road. A policeman stopped and said, "Where's the permit for burning this?" which, of course, the people didn't have. And that's the only reason that saved what there is today of her. Now there are a number of people that are trying to work in keeping her legacy.
Women have come very far in the sciences and other fields in the past few decades. I mean, indeed, in some fields now, women make up the majority in some scientific fields. So are women explorers now operating on a level playing field?
I'm asked this everywhere I go, and unfortunately, no. There are many, many more opportunities now, but it's still extremely difficult. And many women, while they may be admitted, you can study geology now, for instance, which was closed up until really quite recently. It's still hard to get the funding or to get the senior positions, and you can really count the numbers of women that have gone very far. And I'm hoping that a book like this will open up everybody's minds to the fact that women have been contributing and are contributing enormously, and that they should be accorded the equal celebration and financial rewards and positions as their male counterparts.
It has occurred to me to make a collection of all the subtle poisons that Negroes know how to locate among the bush and in the use of which they are so expert. No one outside the hoodoo or bush doctors know these things. But as I am learning day by day, more and more I think that I will be doing medical science a great service to identify these weeds so that antidotes can be prepared. The greatest power of voodoo rests upon this knowledge. Some of these bushes are quite marvelous. One of them I know will kill by being placed so that the wind will blow from it to the victim. Another can be rubbed on the clothing and enters through the pores as soon as the victim sweats.
You can hear Living on Earth on National Public Radio and the World Radio Network. To find a member station near you, go to www.loe.org or www.npr.org. This is Living on Earth Today.